short and ridiculously unedited, four thoughts about what's going on in, yes, Ukraine. I'm Mark Galliotti, and welcome to my view of Russia in Moscow's shadows. This podcast, of varying length, frequency, and format, yet always reassuringly low production values, is supported by generous and perspicacious patrons, who also receive extra perks and bonuses appropriate to their tier. If you'd like to join them, just head on to patreon.com/inmoscowshadows. But now, on with today's programme. Hello, welcome, and yes, that is a different piece of music you'll have heard. It's not necessarily the one I'll finally go for, and I might try and find a more refined version. But in case you don't recognise it, it's from the soundtrack to the film Alexander Nevsky. It's by Sergei Prokofiev, and it's called Arise, Ye Russian People. You may take that however you choose. Anyway, as I said, this is going to be a very short and quite episodic version of the podcast. I'm conscious that I haven't had the time to broadcast so far, and because very first thing tomorrow morning I'm on a plane, rather than making people wait for an extra week, I thought I would knock something out. As I say, this is going to be entirely unedited, so my apologies for whatever ums, ers and mix-ups may occur. Anyway, what I wanted to do was briefly dwell on four points that relate to the current state of the conflict and what it may mean. The first and most obvious one is the new approach that has been announced, that the initial stages of the attack have more or less been completed. You will note they said completed, not successful. And now they are going to focus on the Donbass. Well, look, in some ways, I crow because, firstly, I had said that if they actually want to make any progress, they're going to have to stop trying to advance on all fronts and concentrate on one, and this is what they're doing. And secondly, that precisely they would focus on the Donbass region, not just because that's where they're making progress and that's where they've already got a strong bridgehead with the People's Republics, but also because it fits in with the essential new legitimating narrative, which is, look, of course, this was never about invasion. This was never about the country as a whole, however much nonsense that is. Instead, it's primarily about ensuring that we protect the poor, beleaguered Russians and Russian speakers of the Donbass from the evil neo-Nazi genocide that Kiev and its American backers want to impose, blah, blah, blah. So, in this respect, what does it represent? Well, look, in one level, it represents clearly a further assertion of the fact that a certain amount of military common sense, and presumably then the authority of the generals, is being seen as, you know, this disastrous initial approach is now giving way to another one, which is, in many ways, no less ruthless, if in some ways it's much more ruthless. But the point is, it is also much, much more practical. And of course, this represents, let's be honest, a serious scaling back, and indeed I think one can say defeat, of the Russians' plans. You know, this is not what they intended to do. This is what they're having to do under force of pressure. However, we shouldn't get too cocky about this. This actually allows them to consolidate their positions. If they're not trying to advance, for example, around Kyiv, but instead digging in, yes, they are vulnerable if their supply lines get cut. But on the other hand, they at least now have more of a chance of holding on to what they've got, despite the fact that already the Ukrainians are making some effective, very local counterattacks. But the point is, I mean, we will assume, unfortunately, that Mariupol on the Azov Sea coast will fall in due course. Then they will have achieved their fabled land bridge to Crimea. And that, plus the Donbass, would represent a relatively, and I stress that, a relatively defensible unit. So what it really makes clear is the war is by no means over. Those people who are talking about the Ukrainians winning, well, look, they win by not being defeated. But if winning means pushing the Russians out of every last square foot or square meter of Ukrainian soil, well, that's not likely to happen.
at least not for the foreseeable future. If there is going to be an end to this conflict, rather than just simply a deadlocked stalemate, which is the other sort of likely possibility, it will obviously have to come from peace talks. And look, in this respect, perversely, it's actually a bad sign. It's a bad sign because by consolidating and focusing on areas that actually do matter to Russia, I mean, I think the land bridge as well as Donbass, if they manage to control those areas properly, if they manage to take Mariupol and hold it, and if they then manage to extend their control over the rest of the Donbass region, the temptation, I suspect, in Moscow will precisely be to try and hold on to that. And given, I mean, let's just take Mariupol as example. I mean, back in 2014, it was the predominantly Russian-speaking populations of Mariupol who were actually pushing back against Kyiv. And that may be one of the reasons why the Russians thought that, in fact, they might be welcomed in Mariupol, or at the very least, why the Russians are especially peed off that the people of Mariupol, the traitors, have not actually welcomed the Russians and are therefore, why it's become such a almost symbolic as well as practical battlefield. But the point is, I cannot see Zelensky being willing to give up to Russian control cities such as Mariupol that have fought so hard against that. So I think, if anything, this actually might make the prospects of any kind of negotiated peace, unless, of course, the Russians do take some serious new blows on the battlefield, as well as in the economic war, it might make it less likely. So, again, I always like to see the positive when I can, but I'm not convinced that I can see it there. But again, we will have to see whether or not actually the Russians are able to actually do anything with this new approach. So that's point one. Of course, if we're talking about the Russian military, we have to play the new game, not where's Wally, but where's Shoigu? We saw a brief clip of him, presumably current, recent, rather stiltedly reading out a written report on weapons being provided to the Russian military. But there has been this talk of exactly what's been going on. He, and indeed it's worth noting, Chief of the General Staff Gerasimov, have simply not been seen for quite some time. The official line is apparently that Shoigu suffered a heart attack. Now, this may well be true, and it will certainly explain both why he hasn't been around and also why he didn't exactly look in particularly good shape in that TV clip. Doesn't quite explain why Gerasimov hasn't been around, though, but that's a whole other issue we can come back to. So what are the options? Well, I said, one is, it is exactly what it says on the tin, that Shoigu is enthusiastic, still entirely in favour with Putin, but just simply has been sidelined by a minor, quote-unquote, medical detail of a heart attack. Option two, Shoigu is actually now in disfavour. I mean, there are some people saying he's under investigation. I'm not entirely sure. I mean, yes, obviously, the military is underperforming woefully, and in part that's because clearly reform hasn't gone as deeply as was planned or expected. Clearly there's been corruption. There has been the usual sort of, how can I put this, kind of Potemkin procedures whereby things that were meant to be done were not done. But to a considerable extent, I don't think this is actually about the underlying problems of the military so much as the fact that the military were thrown into this war at ridiculously short notice without all the structures for command that they would maybe meant to have, as I've talked about in a previous podcast, and essentially on a battle plan which just didn't make sense. So now, although obviously hunts for scapegoats do not necessarily have to make sense, but nonetheless, I think it's a little bit unlikely that if they did decide to go after Shoigu, he would be sort of out of sight while they went. A third option is that this is in some ways a political ruse of his own. That, I mean, maybe he's had a heart attack, maybe not. But in fact, he just simply wanted to drop out of sight for a while to save him the blushes of either having to, A, acknowledge that the war is not going the way it was meant to be going, or B, have to dig even deeper and claim that, yes, absolutely, everything is going to plan. Remember, Shoigu, if nothing else, is an exceedingly wily political operator and really quite a survivor. So, I mean, I honestly don't know, but I think it's worth noting these. But the main thing is, what it does demonstrate is the degree to which there is clearly stuff going on behind the scenes within the government, as we would expect. Given that, you know, the boss can never be wrong, there have to be scapegoats. Given that essentially this is an administration that is made up not so much of ideological fellow travellers of Putin's. I mean, there are a few at the top, people like Patrushev and Federal Security Service Director Bortnikov and such like. But below that, to a large extent, these are ruthless opportunists who are Putinists for as long as it makes sense to be Putinist. Now, not saying for a minute that all this talk about, you know, palace coups and such like is anywhere near a possibility at the moment, though things can change quickly, but certainly at the moment, not at all a possibility. I think in some quarters it's being stirred up because of wishful thinking, and in other quarters it's being stirred up as a deliberate information operation precisely to spread more paranoia and mutual mistrust in Moscow. But for whatever reasons, you know, clearly there are different political agendas underway because everyone realizes that this is an absolute disaster. And Shoigu is, in that respect, you know, a potentially interesting bellwether for this. Because after all, this is a man with quite sensitive political antennae, a man who's a bit younger than the rest of the Putin politicians and therefore might have been thinking sort of more about his long-term political career. Well worth watching this space. Okay, shall we have a quick break or shall I roll straight on? Ah, it's 11 minutes 31, so let's just roll straight on. You don't need a break, do you? Third thing to look at, the National Guard, the Rosgvardia. I've always been fascinated, well, I say always, ever since it was created in 2016, I've been fascinated by this institution, which, you know, clearly is a Praetorian Guard force. It took all the various internal security elements of the Ministry of Internal Affairs and turned them into an army under Putin's loyal ex-bodyguard, Putin's Doberman, Viktor Zolotov. And yet, despite having clearly been a very favoured service up to now, not least with all the, you know, a lot of government subventions and the opportunity to build some new, exciting new business opportunities, whereby a lot of senior figures within the National Guard got very, very rich, all of a sudden things don't seem to be going so well. And no wonder. The National Guard played a key role in the initial invasion. And again, it makes sense if and only if you accept the rather nonsensical political bases of it. The idea that the Ukrainian state, remember, this is after all a non-state that is controlling a non-people, but anyway, that this Ukrainian state was going to collapse at the very first push. And therefore it was simply a question of installing some kind of proxy regime and maybe just simply having to maintain law and order, ensure that you don't get protests and such like, which is exactly the kind of thing that the Rosgvardia in its various iterations, the interior troops, the Amon riot troops, and the Sobor kind of police SWAT teams, this is exactly what they do. So on that level, it makes sense. Until and except, of course, when the Ukrainians don't play ball and actually, for some strange reason, insist on fighting back to retain their independence and their sovereignty. And what happens when National Guard, who, I mean, they look the part, they've got all the bulletproof vests and the guns and everything else, but they are not trained for real warfare, and they are certainly not equipped for it. And when they tangle with regular troops, they come off very badly indeed. And we know that there's been a lot of casualties amongst the National Guard. And therefore, it shouldn't surprise that we're now beginning to see some kind of pushback, some kind of resistance. We've heard a lot of grumbling already. People and various, you know, surviving social media channels frequented by National Guard complaining that they're being used as cannon fodder, etc. Not without reason. But now we've got this interesting case in which 12 National Guard officers from Krasnodar actually are refusing to go to Ukraine because, quite rightly, they say that their condition of service does not actually require them to go outside of Russia's borders. There's an interesting situation whereby National Guard can be deployed abroad under a law that was passed a couple of years ago, but on the other hand, they cannot be required to serve abroad. Technically speaking, like conscripts, they only go abroad when they volunteer. And these 12 guys are most definitely not volunteering. And what's interesting is this has become a court case. They have a lawyer who's arguing their case. And it's becoming public. I mean, look, I'm not going to say that mainstream Russian media is making a big deal of it. But, you know, but nonetheless, these people were not just instantly swept up and disappeared into some deep, dark military penitentiary. And I think whatever the outcome of their case, and I don't really think it's going to go that well for them, call me cynical, but whatever the outcome of their case, you know, this has become known within National Guard circles. And I think that's really interesting, because the point at which they still feel that they can actually use the structures of the law to avoid being sent into this war means that they, A, still have some kind of confidence in the law, which is quite sweet, but B, the fact that they are willing to actually make a public stand. This is not just simply about the kind of covert resistance that we've already seen. Soldiers ditching their spare fuel tank so they just literally don't have enough fuel to get to Kyiv, that kind of thing, wherein, you know, no one can really prove it because, you know, your whole unit is sworn to secrecy. No, this is actually people quite publicly saying, no, hell no, we won't go. And that's going to be something, again, well worth seeing, because remember, the National Guard are also the people who are the front line when the Kremlin is worried about public protest. And we may well see public protest. The economic situation is getting worse. There's less food in the shops. The overall estimate, as I've seen it, and again, no one really knows for sure, is that there's going to be enough food around, at least so people are not starving in the main. What's really the problem is the distribution system. Without necessarily having the market to rely on, you know, can you make sure that the food is where it needs to be to make sure that people have enough? Because if you don't, then that's when people do start to protest. And the temptation from the statists who surround Putin, after all, will be to move to state-led options like ration cards and the like, which will really, really look bad for Putin. So one way or the other, these National Guardsmen may well be expected to defend the state structures, just as they are getting more and more annoyed, shall we say, with how they're being treated by that same state structure. And this goes all the way up to the top, because we've had the case of the deputy commander of the National Guard overall, General Roman Gavrilov, who has been arrested. And the charges are of leaking official information, classified information, and potentially also a little bit of fraud and embezzlement. I mean, when it comes down to it, what Russian official could not be accused of and presumably convicted of fraud and embezzlement? You know, who lives on their salary alone? But there you go, that's just part of the system. But again, the interesting thing about this is exactly, we have a public case of the deputy head of the National Guard, and particularly the leaking. I mean, that implies that, you know, leaking, you leak accurate information, you don't leak lies. Leaking lies is, I don't know, spreading disinformation or whatever. If you're accused of leaking, then implicitly it's saying that what you've been putting out is true, which is an interesting kind of own goal from the Kremlin. But more generally, or perhaps more importantly, the word is that the head of the National Guard, General Zolotov, tried to go and see Putin to argue Gavrilov's case. And Putin didn't want to see him. So this is one of the most doggedly loyal of the figures around. This is a man who has no political career, no professional future, if Putin is not in the Kremlin. I mean, this is a man who is widely despised by his peers, those who actually think he's even worth despising. I mean, on the whole, he's generally regarded as a moron and a dangerous, violent moron at that. He relies on Putin, and Putin knows that and has obviously based his decision to make Zolotov in some ways the ultimate backstop of his rule on that very basis, that precisely this is a man on whom he can rely. And yet even Putin is snubbing him. I mean, this is the very best, one could say, a lack of particular political nous on Putin's side. And at worst, something else. Again, we come back to this. Stuff is happening behind the scenes. And all we get to see, I mean, it's the old actually parallel of that. So it was about Soviet politics at the time. Soviet politics was like watching bulldogs fight under a carpet. There's a lot of sound and fury, but you have no idea what's going on until some bones pop out from under the carpet. Well, that's what we're seeing. It'll be interesting to see whose bones eventually pop out. final point I wanted to talk about, which is in some ways a particularly fanciful one, but I just thought it was an interesting one to note. I'm just kind of putting the final touches on a book that has, one would think, absolutely no connection with what's going on, which is a little Osprey book looking at the clashes between the Teutonic Knights and the warriors of medieval Lithuania, which, if you don't know about it, actually is a fascinating story about Lithuania and how Lithuania became what one can almost think of as one of the regional superpowers, especially in alliance with Poland, of northeastern Europe. But anyway, the thing that struck me was you have this country, Lithuania, which was much more united than the other pagan countries, or pagan regions, I should say, of northern Europe. Because this is the time of the Baltic Crusades. The Lithuanians were still pagans, and as a result, they were fair game to the phenomenally brutal depredations of particularly, but not exclusively, the Teutonic Order. Which, incidentally, another little sideline, if you don't know this, the Teutonic Order basically turned crusading into a kind of club med or club 18 to 30 activity, whereby younger, above all, knights from across Europe who wanted to hone their battle skills, have some glory, eat and drink a lot, and also basically get pardoned for their various sins. And trust me, medieval aristocrats tended to have a lot of sins that needed pardoning. Well, rather than going all the way to the Holy Land, which was a lengthy, difficult, and dangerous trip, you could just go to, largely it was Prussia at first, and you sign on for these reisen, these journeys, which the Teutonic Knights would arrange. It was basically twice a year the Teutonic Knights would arrange raids into pagan-held lands, which could last just a fortnight, all the way up to several months. Some of them are smaller, some of them are big military expeditions. But the basic thing is you go there, you pay, you get banquets and everything else laid on by the Teutonic Knights. You go and fight and burn and kill and take slaves. Oh, no, not slaves, prisoners. And, you know, generally do the kind of thing that medieval warrior aristocrats do. At the same time, feeling you're doing it to glorify the greater god, who apparently seems to enjoy plunder and rapine. And then at the end, you can head home, feeling job well done, and more to the point, you've had a lot of fun. So the Teutonic Knights essentially get you to pay to come and provide extra military muscle for their military operations against the heathen, whom incidentally they tended to call Saracens, because after all, Saracens, heathens, you know, doesn't matter if they're Balts or people from the Middle East. Anyway, I do digress. So, essentially you have more than two centuries of war between Lithuania, the Grand Duchy of Lithuania, and the Teutonic Ordensstaat, the state of the Teutonic military order. And the interesting thing is, looking at it, is the extent to which it is precisely the constant and violent pressure of the Teutonic Crusade that in some ways not only makes Lithuania into an increasingly unified, unitary, and well-working state, but also actually forces it dramatically to up its game in terms of its military tradecraft and also its military technology. So instead, you know, they move from being, you know, essentially a kind of halfway between tribal and feudal system whereby, you know, local aristocrats and gentry and landowners would sort of get together, they'd raise some levies, they go off and have a little raid, and then they come back. Increasingly one in which actually you have a state that can build, you know, large brick-built castles like Kaunas that was besieged, that increasingly can actually field larger and more organized armies, that can field armies that also have full sort of siege trains so that they can actually besiege the extraordinarily well-built castles of the Teutonic Knights, and also that the military aristocrats of the Lithuanians increasingly sort of basically take on a lot of the military technologies and style of warfare of the knights, even actually raiding Teutonic Knight stud farms so that they can get mares and stallions from which they can breed their own big, heavy war horses, because you need big, heavy war horses in order to basically have heavily mounted knights on top. And so by the time you have a particularly sort of devastating victory over the Teutonic Order in 1410, in which they're defeated by the Polish-Lithuanian Union, as is by that stage, actually the best-equipped Lithuanians are equipped just as well as the Teutonic Knights, who in turn have the finest apparel available to a medieval knight. A lengthy diversion, but to be honest, as I said, I'm quite fascinated by this at the moment. But the thing that strikes me is how far this is an interesting metaphor or example of the same process that has taken place with Ukraine. Because the thing about Ukraine is it's had 8 years to prepare for this war. It's had 8 years of constant pressure. It's had 8 years of the kind of low-level attacks, I mean, individually often very serious, but compared with this, not a full-scale war, along the so-called line of contact around the People's Republics, which means they have got to test out how they respond to a whole variety of Russian approaches and Russian weapon systems. I mean, this is in some ways the irony. We have our forces and things like the British Operation Orbital to go and train the Ukrainian forces, which clearly there is all kind of stuff that they can and do learn. But when it comes to, for example, fighting Russian tanks, I mean, the Ukrainians have vastly more experience than we do in how to take on a modern Russian T-72, B-3 or whatever. So actually what's happened is, much like, over a 200-year period, but in this case just eight, much like the Lithuanians, facing constant pressure from a truly implacable enemy that starts looking much more powerful, much more technologically advanced, but also seems absolutely and implacably opposed to your very existence, is a phenomenal spur to development. And so again, as in so many ways, the Ukrainians can, obviously, ultimately, they themselves take credit for it themselves, and their own spirit, their own imagination, how well they have prepared. But the person who really gave them the opportunity to learn, the need to learn, that real spur to doing so, was, of course, Vladimir Putin. In so many ways, this war has demonstrated the degree to which someone like Vladimir Putin can basically undermine and ultimately maybe even destroy himself. So that's my little closing thought. As I say, my apologies, this is a high-speed thing. My entire preparation was four bullet points, one of which, just to make sure I remember the name, is also includes the name of Roman Gavrilov. And apart from that, though, I'm just rambling at length. And when I start to ramble, that is a pretty good sign that I should stop. And I promise I will try and make sure that the next podcast is a little bit more organized. Thank you all.
Well, that's the end of another episode of the In Moscow Shadow podcast. Just as a reminder, beyond this, you can follow my blog, also called In Moscow Shadows. Follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galliotti, or Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. This podcast is made possible by generous and enlightened patrons, and you too can be one. Just go along to my Patreon page, that's patreon.com/inmoscowshadows, and decide which tier you want to join, getting access to exclusive materials and other perks. However, whether or not you contribute, thank you very much indeed for listening. Until next time, keep well. И только будь, пожалуйста, со мной.